Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a shadow of my former self. And I'm feeling a bit like a ghost and also altered and changed. And they are all phrases that I have definitely said in the 41 years that I've been on this planet through different breakups, through kind of sexual violence, you know, the death of family members, including my brother and my dad and like loads of my cousins and just onwards. And I've been thinking a lot recently about how we can be so changed and hurt by each other and by each other's actions. And even like the most subtle thing could really be a huge blow to someone's self-confidence, self-esteem. And it's the kind of conversations I've been having with lots of artists and musician friends of mine here in Margate. But it's something that I think we all think about. And maybe we've been thinking about it more through the pandemic as well, because I think for some of us, like me included, like when you're living alone or when you're confronted with less people, you have to sort of face yourself. And today's guest's work I've been familiar with for actually a really long time, because I first met her through an art advisor called Lauren, maybe like 14 years ago or something, like a long time ago. And I remember seeing the work back then, and it really touched me because our artist guest was making kind of embroidered work on personal clothing. So kind of like bras or like panties or knickers or whatever the word is, because I know we're speaking to someone who's in America right now, but they are English though. So I'm sure they understand our words too. And I remember being really moved by it. And over that period of time, her work has grown and developed so much. And for me, it kind of makes even more sense now, like looking back at the breadth of work, because she's worked across different mediums and, you know, almost like different series as well, very specific series. And when you see them all now as a greater whole, like it's so powerful. And at the moment, the reason we have invited her to talk on the show with us is because she's just made a brand new film, and it blew you away to the point where you called me up and you were like, I've just seen the most amazing film. You have to watch it. And then I'd weirdly seen our guest in London last October and had the most amazing evening. And I was already thinking about inviting her on Talk Art. So it was one of these weird like moments. And the film is just devastatingly powerful, and everybody has to see this film. It's a great work of art, and it crosses so many different topics, but also kind of mediums, I think, like in the sense of like acting versus art versus like reality, you know, documentary. It's really full on.
Spoken word,
like poetry, exactly. So anyway, we would like to welcome to Talk Art, all the way from Brooklyn, New York, Zoe Buckman.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. What a beautiful intro. And just thank you for what you guys do, both separately and together, to amplify our voices and have these conversations. I've been following you both for years. As you said, Robert, we've known each other for a long fucking time. But I'm just really glad to be sitting down having a chat with you. So thank you.
Us too. Yeah. So whereabouts are you right now? It looks like you're in your studio.
Oh my God. I'm in Dumbo, Brooklyn, which is also known as the deadest, most like dry part of Brooklyn ever. Hence why I am leaving.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I am so boarding a midnight train to Bed-Stuy.
Are you?
Yes, cool. Babes. I was about to say yes, bitch, but I don't know, all the feminists are going to get so mad. But no, I say bitch in the most endearing way, of course.
I actually saw a fan of yours on Google say that you're a badass feminist, and I was like, we are here for that.
Yeah, man, we are so here for that.
Talk Art loves that.
Dumbo, I love Dumbo. I always find Dumbo quite triggering as a word, because that was my nickname as a kid with my ears sticking out. So every time someone says Dumbo, like, I instantly go back, regress, like, to being about 6 or 7.
Oh, bless you. You know, kind of clench a little bit.
Exactly, tiny amount. But there's a Soho House in Dumbo. You must obviously pop in and out there.
It's lovely, and they have my work, which is super sweet. They do, yeah. Thank you, Kate Bryan.
That's who I saw you with, wasn't it? I saw you with Kate Bryan, who was a guest at that time on our podcast. Yeah. I think we just recorded her podcast, so that's really funny. Yeah, I forgot you, Kate.
Yeah.
So Kate Bryan is just amazing. But yeah, I am in Brooklyn, and I live... So we're in my living room right now, because this is where I make my work. I have an intimate art practice in that... I don't like to call it small, because I don't want to sort of dumb down my own work, but it's just me, guys. It's me in my living room making this stuff. And it's kind of awesome. I love that. And so... You know, when lockdown first hit and some of my friends with these big studios, and they had to furlough their staff, and suddenly their foundry in Asia was closed down. And I was like, you know, well, I've just been making my work this whole time, so I know how to just keep going with that. So I was kind of unaffected by that big change. But all that to say, because I know there's lots of artists who listen to your work listen to this podcast, sorry, but living with one's work where there's no separation is a blessing and a curse. And it's, you know, I can roll out of bed jet lagged and just get to work in my PJs, but then at the same time, there's no separation and I can't turn it off at night. And, you know, we're all obviously you know, a little anal retentive about what we create, but I also create from a place of trauma and things that I have found difficult. And so I don't want and should not live with it when I'm having my breakfast cereal. So that's part of why I'm moving to Bed-Stuy, because I'm moving into a space where I can have the studio on the ground floor and I can live above it. And also, yeah, Dumbo's dead, man.
Well, this thing you're saying,
you heard it here first.
This sound like a blessing and a curse just makes me feel like that kind of is... The fundamentals of your practice is that you work within oppositions. So you have like grief and joy, violence and softness, partying and praying, the masculine and the feminine. So this kind of being within this blessing and a curse situation, I would say would be inspiring for you.
Yeah. I think that is, thank you for seeing that, because I feel like probably the biggest thread, pun intended, throughout everything that I've made has been this intersection of two polarized states, masculine and feminine, violence and joy and all of those things. I think from a mental health perspective, it's time that I don't live in that liminal space in between polarized states all the time.
Yeah.
What would it be like if my home was just peaceful or just fun? You know, let's have the trauma in a room we can shut the door. I'm into that.
Yeah. Do you find that you transfer the trauma somehow, like, out of you? It's almost like purging it into the objects. Because I feel like the way you make a lot of your work, I mean, even the film, weirdly, because the film is so detailed on so many levels, which we'll talk about later. But if you think about really basic ideas of how I first discovered your work, I guess, but the embroidery, like, there's something so kind of tactile, full on and detailed about that approach.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's that process, you know, you're piercing, well, a couple of things. One is that when you're sewing something, and I use a lot of embroidery, not exclusively, as you guys know, but I guess it is the thing that I am doing most is sewing, and has been for some years now. And so you get this perhaps fragile piece of textile, and I'm then piercing it, I don't know, 100,000 times with a needle. And in that, I am releasing something, some pain, some energy there, in the same way that I think I was attracted to boxing. And I didn't expect, when I first started boxing, for it to have such a big and formative effect on me. But it actually kind of leads into the other point about close work like embroidery, which for me is about control. And I think, and sorry if this is all just a bit broad, but I think that I'm realizing that growing up in Hackney in the 80s and 90s, when there was a lot of violence from, you know, being broken into and robbed 6-7 times, to being mugged at knife point, to experiences, of course, with boys in state schools, and even violence within my own home, because I had grew up with three, four men in my home. So what was I trying to say? Oh, yeah. Lots of like big personalities, lots of like masculinity, lots of toxic masculinity. And that has, it meant that I didn't feel growing up in that environment that I had a voice or a place, that I had anything to say. In fact, you kind of wanted to disappear, which I became good at. And then years later, I start developing my art practice, and I find that the mediums that most feel intuitively right for me are ones in which I can control everything that happens, where I'm not outsourcing my work to somebody else, where if a mistake happens, I see it, whoops, cut it, start again, unpick, let's go. And I think that that sense of control has been very important to me as someone who has experienced quite a lot of violence. And then, where was I going with this? Boxing. So then when I started boxing, it was that strange kind of push and pull, in that I walked into the boxing gym, and it was this underground Puerto Rican spot downtown New York, and just the smell of it, I was like, oh, I'm actually kind of attracted to this space. I was like, I smell the testosterone, this is nasty, nasty, nasty. And like, I said, it was almost nostalgic. I was like, yeah, okay, killer, let's go. Like, I was like, started to get big and walk in there. They were like, who's this girl in a dress? Like, what's happening here? But it became this space where I could both reconnect to a lot of what I miss about London, about Hackney, about my upbringing, because it wasn't all bad. And I could reconnect with the energy of my brothers. And I could also work through experiences that I'd had where I'd had my power taken away from me. And in the art world as a woman, when I had just started to be asked to speak about my work, I was incredibly shy. And so boxing and learning how to protect my body and to hold my space and to take space away from somebody else, it just really opened things up for me, and of course led, sort of bled into my work.
You know, it's really funny. I just started boxing in the last month, and I'm doing it because I need to get fit again after COVID and all that stuff. And I was so shocked by boxing because it's not what I expected. I thought it was going to be like really kind of like getting all your angst out and all this kind of stuff. But what I've realized is it's all about focus, and it's all about kind of like almost like a calmness within yourself. And yes, it's exhausting, mainly in your legs, weirdly. But like, is there something about the focus of it that's kind of helped you?
Absolutely. And I think that was like one of the first things that they said to me. I was training with the owner of the gym, Gennaro Diaz. And we would have so much banter. I would call him hooker and bitch and shit just to like fuck with him. He loved it. I'd be like, come on in, hooker, let's go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was like, okay, we know you're scrappy. But you got to stay calm. He's like, I don't need to teach you how to be scrappy. I need to teach you how to like take that energy and how to sort of expend it over time, because you're going to gas out in the first round. And actually, yeah, like you said, boxing is about kind of pulling back and, you know, evading and tricking and stuff. And you have to be so focused for that.
And ducking.
Listen, be careful. Be careful of your lumbar spine, babes.
God, yeah.
I've been. Yeah. I always find boxing was like a dance choreography when you do it. Yeah. It's all about, you know, hit, duck, turn, look. Yes. When you're treating it in like a workout way, it is choreography.
You take it to RuPaul, Russ.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
flick, down, slut drop,
and duck
uppercut.
Walk.
Exactly. So boxing, right? So boxing. There's a lot. So we've covered a lot already. What you're talking? No, it's great. But let's go back. So the materiality you talked about, and you talked about boxing. So when people look at your work now, they're going to see boxing gloves. They're going to see lots of boxing paraphernalia. But the materiality of what the boxing paraphernalia is surrounded with is what you were talking about, this very parenthesis, woman's domestic materiality. So there is, again, this opposition, or you have something that is very masculine, like, you know, a stereotype of boxing, and then you have this very feminine energy that is encompassing it, that is cuddling it and hugging it and keeping it in. So the boxing came to you in 2016, and that has a correlation with Donald Trump. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah, actually, yeah, totally. Yeah. So wait, is there more to that question?
No, I was going to say, I want to know how the boxing
Buckling
came into your life.
Waffle.
No.
Okay, so real talk, it was the war on women and the fact that we were gearing up yet again for another general election, and that's when all these old white dudes, straight cis, get together and start publicly saying things about rape and abortion, and about abortion that is the result of rape, and it's like, whoa, whoa. So there was that going on, but at the same time, I was also getting divorced. And so my whole personal life was shifting, and I was engaged, and I'm sure my ex-husband would agree. We were both at war with each other and at war with ourselves, and sort of, you know, what we knew to be of our lives, everything was in flux. And so I just felt like I was fighting, and I'm fighting with my work about the status quo. And then I turn on my TV and I read the news and I'm fighting, and then I'm going home and I'm fucking fighting. And it was just, I needed boxing to come in and teach me how to slow down, breathe, center yourself, own your space, but also like be graceful, you know? Mm. I think the boxing really helped with my divorce, actually. But yes, that it was during that time that I first started to want to bring the iconography in the boxing gym into my studio. And I've always used vintage or antique textiles, and that's super important to me. I think, it's just I'm personally drawn to things that have had a life before they got to me. Yeah. I feel like there's stories there that I can sort of, I don't know, build upon. So I started to collect. At first, it was used wedding dresses and construct these sculptural clusters.
Was this what would use wedding dresses as used going through a divorce?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Again, that's an opposition.
Yeah. there's an NDA
or
as well, but
reflection.
Yeah. So that was a series called Let Her Rave, and again, so I want to talk more about like the home and the dishcloths and the doilies and all of that.
But work is so autobiographical then for everyone listening and coming to it.
Oh, big time.
Everything we're looking at comes from your cherry picking, or not cherry picking, you're choosing your life and you're putting it into your, you know, multifaceted practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And working with the wedding dresses was super depressing, particularly when you're in the throes of or have just gotten divorced. But really, you know what I was looking
at. Can I go back on that
first?
Then?
Yes.
Why did you do that then? Why do you think that you were going through the throes of divorce, but you chose the wedding dress as something which is very triggering? Why that? Why that? Why you would bring that into your practice?
Yeah, good question. Thank you, sir. I've always been super fascinated by the Madonna whore complex. And I think when we're talking about these polarized ideas, that is one of the most, governing concepts to the female experience. At least it has been in my lived experiences of relationships with men. So I wanted to use these wedding dresses because to me they represented chastity and purity and perfection. Like all brides want their wedding dresses and their weddings to be perfect. And I was exploring the experience of what it was like to have been in relationships that I'm either sort of put on a pedestal and revered, but not kind of touched and not seen in my totality and my messiness and my flaws and the darkness, the wilderness within, or relationships in which it's the opposite, where I'm not respected in any way or kept safe. And of course, we all know, like, I guess for me with my artwork, and this leads back to the film, of course, is that we all know that rape is bad and we all know that violence is bad. And I'm not trying to say that with my work. I'm trying to invite these sort of nuanced conversations, like, what is that space in between a Madonna and a whore? And how entrenched is it in our ideas of women? You know, like, let's really dissect and unpack that. And this isn't just looking at ideas that men put on women. It's also ideas that women put on each other and continue to do so, because I think the patriarchy is so entrenched and ingrained from so young. So was the wedding dresses.
That idea, because I've been talking a lot with Self Esteem, who's a musician, Rebecca Lucy Taylor and Lindsay Mendick, and they both in their work, the thing that I really connected, which I think is similar to yourself, is that instead of just like blaming someone else, they also like reflect on themselves and their own behavior and the way that they did things and how that might have, you know, been part of a bigger situation. Not saying that it validates any violence or anything like that, of course not. But what I find in the nuancedness, you know, talking about how we do all treat each other, because it is like two-sided in at times, you know, and relationships are about two people coming together. And I find that really interesting in your work as well, like kind of reflections on your own behavior, your own self or something. Like it's really touching.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's why it was super important to me in the film. One of the last lines is, and as you guys know, it's an exploration in large part of intimate violence within a relationship. But it was super important to me that I included this line that says, and even after all, she pleaded him to stay.
Yeah.
Because that's my true lived experience. And I that was important to me, you know.
I also think it's that complex thing of like blame as well. Like if you experience sexual violence, how you still blame yourself for it, even though it isn't your fault, you know, and categorically, it's not your fault. But like, I think that's such a dark kind of, and such a regular thing. Like so many people experience that. And also like loss of memory and all these kind of things and the way you can mix things up. It's so confusing. And, yeah, and I don't know. I just think it's great that you're able to find this space within the art to kind of bring up more of a nuanced discussion. It's not one way or the other. It's just very, very, very complicated.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, we talked about that with the film. I said to you, this film, and people aren't going to be able to watch this film yet. And we're talking about this. It'd probably be quite frustrating, but there needs to be an area of discussion around the film when people do see it. But also around your work, you know, and what we're talking about now is intense stuff. This is stuff that we need to discuss, and this is what your work brings up. And I think this discussion around your work, do you feel a responsibility for your work for other people, the way that they are receiving it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm proud of my Britishness and my Londonness in that respect, because I think what you've seen, Russell, in like plays that you've done in the UK and shows that, I'm sorry, just for a second, just a fangirl moment, but oh my God, years and years, what? Like I watched it alone and I don't even want to, if people haven't seen it, I don't want to ruin, but you and your storyline made me unwell, bruv. Oh. Made me unwell. I couldn't unsee it. I couldn't stop thinking about it. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure at the end of that episode, there would have been some kind of statement, isn't it? About like, here's a resource if you have been affected. Da, da, da. And that's a very commonly UK thing. They don't really do that out here, like at all. And they certainly do not do it in art spaces. And I really want to be aware when I do show this film, and whether that's institutionally or it's screened in a festival or whatnot, I want to consider, and even if I have to consult with the right people about this, what's the environment? Because guess what? It shouldn't be a pitch black room. it should be a dark room so you can see the film, but not so, but you should be able to know how you leave, and you should be able to be aware of your body in relationship to other people's bodies. Because I'm not trying to re-traumatize or trigger people. You know, is it warm? Yes, it should be warm. What resources are available to people afterwards? And I think that, you know, and then of course, like, discussions and all of that stuff. But I really do feel a responsibility, honestly. And it's not, and I'm proud to feel a responsibility for the viewers, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. It's almost like that term trigger warning, which you see so much now. And I do really appreciate it in the sense of social media or something. It's quite a new phenomenon in the last year or so, but I think that's developing more and more, because it's like it makes you aware that if you have had an experience and, you know, you might be traumatized or re-traumatized from watching it, at least you go in a bit prepared for it. And then also you can probably feel more like you can leave if you need to. You're kind of more aware that you might need to leave.
Yeah. It makes you think of when we saw Tracy's exhibition. They didn't have a disclaimer. She had a film about having an abortion, and there was no disclaimer before you walked in. And then within like a few days, they had to put a big disclaimer on the door to let people know, because I think people stumbled in and was like, "Whoa, we was not expecting this."
People were crying. There was, you know, and I'm sure they will be to your film. Yeah. And the thing about your film, so can we explain what this film is? This film is a portrait of three women, and they could be one person. It could be like. But I think the message in it so much is that these three women are completely different. They come from completely different backgrounds, and yet they are, you know, sharing in a similar experience, and that there are commonalities between all of us. That was the kind of thing that I took from it, that even if you feel like you're totally alone, there are other people experiencing literally in the same moment what's happening to you. Mm. And you can get help, you can reach out, you can find others to sort of be there for you, I think. But can you speak a bit about how the film and these three women?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it started because in 2018 I was asked by the New York Times to write an 300-word essay on my experience of 2018. They were reaching out to me, obviously, because that was the beginning of the Me Too movement. So they're probably like, shit, we last minute need a woman making work about women, shit. So they reached out to me, and they said it could be as abstract as you like. So I was like, ooh, if you tell an artist that they can write something as abstract as they like, I was like, let me crack my knuckles. And so I started to think about things that I had said and men had said to me, what I'd said in response to situations with men. And I wrote this poem, short poem, and it started off with the words, I told him I could get blood out of anything. Women have been getting blood out of fabric since time immemorial. That was how it started out. It later changed a bit. And at the time that was taken almost verbatim from the relationship that I was in at the time. And I wove together this short piece of writing, and it had some things from my mother's writing about her experience of coming on her period for the first time. And it had some things that my then female boxing coach was describing a bruise. And I wove together this thing. I sent it to the New York Times, and they said, absolutely not. No one will understand this. This is way too abstract. So I was like, okay, y'all are so boring, but that's fine. So I wrote something really, really basic, and I gave it to them, and they said, thank you, this will do. And then I had this, the beginning of a piece of text, which has later grown to be Show Me Your Bruises Then, which was this ongoing piece of writing. And when the relationship that I was in at that time ended, I realized that it was time for me to really address the totality of what had gone on in that relationship. And so this piece of writing, which I'd already been making these embroidered works from, what was 3 pages became 7 pages. And after some time, I took a look at it and I was like, you know what? I think that this could live in some kind of performance. I've had little snippets live in different ways, and now I'd like to see the whole of it performed. And I was like, well, I know some actresses, luckily, because my mum was the head of acting at RADA, like, before she passed. So, yeah, that's how I'm stuck with you lot, man. I cannot get away from you people. Please, God. God, liberate me from the actors. Oh, my goodness.
Did you not want to be an actor then, if that was your...
Hell no. No, really? Remember, small, small, small. Control, control. I'm not trying to have someone tell me what to say, babes. Never again. But so anyway, I know Kush Jumbo, and I'm a huge fan of her.
Spectacular talent.
Love her. And I sent it first to her. And I did that thing of being like, I didn't want to put a brethren on the spot. So I was like, Kush, I've made this poem and I think I want to make a little like film of it. And like, do you know any actresses that who might be interested? She read it, goes, yeah, come on then, mate. Me. So then I was like, oh wow, sick. Oh my god, thanks. And then I took it to Sienna Miller. And I was like, Kush is doing this thing. Do you know of any actresses? She said, yes, me. And then I took it to a third actress who was living in Chicago, and she said yes. So then I had it all ready and we were cast and we were good to go. And then like this thing called COVID happened. You guys remember that? Why, well, yeah, I know. That was a little blip in history. And so it ground to a halt. And the actress in Chicago was like, I ain't getting on a plane ever again. You're on your own. So then I went back to Sienna and I was like, genuinely, please, can you help me cut? I need a third woman. It was super important to me that it was three voices, as if we're all sat at a table and you don't know past, present, future, or literal or what. And she said, no, I can't help you because it's you. You're the third woman.
Oh, wow.
I shut up. She was like, so we've all heard you do your little impressions and bits at dinner. And this is your story and you're the authentic link between me and Kush. And listen, she sold it to me good. And she was like, also, there's a long history, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a long history of female artists putting themselves in their work as they're not. I was like, ah, yeah. And I realized that I was being given an opportunity to go so, so far out of my comfort zone. You know, I'd never like formally written anything. I'd never directed anything. I'd certainly never acted in anything. And suddenly I was going to do all three and I was shit scared. And I think that's, you know, what I'm here for is to challenge myself.
It's, I mean, the reason the film works so well is because you're so possessed in those words. Mm. Like, you mean every single syllable. And it is your performance, actually, for me, that really do, I think if you hadn't been in it, it wouldn't have been the same film because you wrote the words. Do you know what I mean? And you feel it.
I love
the contrast.
You watch it on a different vibration, knowing that the words came from you. But this also feels like a culmination of everything, because text is important to you. And, you know, you talked about your mother at RADA and she was a playwright. Verse, word, that is so important, language. And a lot of your applique pieces have your text going through it, one lines, poems. But these, watching the film and seeing the works of art, the lines appear in the film. So yeah. It feels like a lot of your works before are now in this movie. And it's like everything has been building up to this seminal, I would say, piece of work in your practice. And it's all been there throughout. And it's like, there's a work that says, for this you need thick bleach and euphemisms.
Yeah.
And that's an applique work.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been embroidering that for some years.
And that line, just like, that's one of the first lines that kind of hit you between the eyes. You're like, oh my God. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's really so impressive.
I know,
and
we're like
exciting.
Really excited about
cry.
This. But can I say one thing about this film? The other thing is, the other two performers in it are obviously really well known actors. Like
Kush
has just got, what did she just win an Oscar?
She was Hamlet. Yeah, she won.
Oh no, she was Hamlet.
She's up. Yeah. She's up for the Olivier, and
that's right, the Olivier.
She has a the thing that the Queen gives you. What is it? I was going to say a BFA. That's not right.
MBA. Has she got an MBA?
Yeah, baby.
Wow.
Yeah, you have one yet, Russell?
Not yet.
He'll get
Come
one.
Come on, man. Oh. Listen, if the Queen is listening, it's time. It's been time.
It is
the
time.
The Queen needs to get an MBA to
knew she
Queen.
Was. Yeah. I knew she was very lauded anyway as an actress, and she's amazing. And then Sienna is super well known, and you know, people have seen her on stage, in films, like when she was in Factory Girl, it changed my life. She is extraordinary, like totally extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I've always found her to be very
watchable.
very watchable, but also quite otherworldly.
Yes.
Like she's almost, and that otherworldliness comes across so much in your film. Like
it's timeless. It's a timeless energy.
Oh my God.
It could be the 60s. It could be like the 80s. It's now. You're regressing.
She's extraordinary.
You're a mother, you're a grandmother, you're all the characters. It's like, well, who are you? You're a daughter. It plays with the kind of hierarchy within, as you're saying, like the Madonna, the whore, the crone, the maiden. All of these elements are in this performance.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
She really brings this vulnerability and this fragility. There's almost like things that I didn't have to direct these women at all. I was like, here's the writing, go, let's, yeah, thank you, and cut. But Sienna, like the stuff that she does with her, even with like her hands and how she makes her body small, it was, I think the performance, like you said, is so amazing. And then Kush, the power and the gravitas that she brings to her performance, the enjoyment she takes over the words, I mean, it's just, like gutting. It's like you wish when you look back at moments, it's like, I wish I had been Kush, but I was Sienna. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, in that moment where you're like, this is how I wish it, like when you play it back in your mind, you're like, this is how I wish it had been. This is how I remember it. And somewhere in there is reality.
I know, and that's the thing, it's not artifice, and that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, it's not really acting at all, because both of them give these really true performances. They kind of like reach really deep inside and present you a version of their own truth, which is just so impactful. And I think that's made me realize that when you see performances, like Russell recently was on the West End with Amari Douglas, and the two of them were in Constellations together, and both of their performances, they just like had these moments where they would draw into themselves as humans, not as the character they're playing, but it's like, and they are obviously the character they're playing, but they draw within this kind of depth of their own experience to then reveal the character. But because it's so real, it's just, you have these moments that a pin could drop literally, and you want to cry or something. Yes. And that's what I felt in this film. And it's really rare to see something that kind of, I don't know, that
you
sort of grabs your
very,
heart.
Very proud and excited.
Honestly, people have to see this film. I feel like we should work out a way of like, I don't know, screening it or something. I would love to.
Yeah, what is your plan for it then? What are you going to do?
I don't know. So I only just finished it. The final color grade happened like 2 weeks ago. And then I sent it to you guys. So I, there's you know, there's two different routes, right? Because there's the film festival thing, and then there's the, do I show it in institutions? I feel very strongly that it needs to not be a gallery or a commercial space in that way. So that's what I'm trying to navigate, and I look forward to, you know, any insights or ideas about that at a later date from you guys, because I really want to show it in London in some way. I mean, it's three British women, you know.
Do you miss Hackney?
So much. I mean, my favorite people in the world live in London. I do miss Hackney. Hackney has obviously changed. It's almost unrecognizable. There's still little bits where it feels nostalgic, but I do miss London. Yeah, I love it.
But you don't come back because your daughter's in the States, right?
Yes, she's in school here, so I don't come back as often as I would like, but I do come back and forth as much as possible.
How did you find art being from Hackney? I mean, I guess you were from a cultured parentage. How did art seem like the route for you?
Yeah, so I went to quite shit state schools, but I was around a lot of creative characters at home. So I feel like the home was really a place where expression was fostered, and also ideas about feminism. Like, for example, my name, Zoe Buckman, I have my mother's surname. Because my parents, my dad was like, absolutely, you should have your mother's name. She's extraordinary. I was like, shut up, dad.
Shut up, man. Don't talk about my mom like that. But yeah, so it was a feminist household, give or take. And yeah, how did I find art? It's a good question. I mean, I always wanted to create and I always was creating. And then I came to that crossroad where it's like, okay, do I go to university to get some, you know, a formal degree to fall back on, or do I go to art school? And I decided that I would go to Manchester University and get a degree in English literature with theatre and film. However, God, I did go for 1 year, but I also fell in love with an Aussie bartender and he decided to move from Australia to Manchester to live with me. And so I was waitressing and I had this, you know, older boyfriend who was, it's like I'd taken him from the beach to the, no offense to Manchester, but you know, he was not happy. And I was working my ass off so that I could pay rent. And I felt responsible for this being who I was promptly really kind of going off. So all that to say, I dropped out of Manchester after a year and was like, fuck it. I just want to keep creating. And I ended up going to school here in New York, actually.
You studied photography?
I did, yeah. Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That exactly. Was your first route into it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lens-based artwork, so photography and film. But I'm only just now returning to lens-based with Show Me Your Bruises then.
But you can really see your history in it, because in this film, one of the reasons it's so powerful, I think, is the composition of it set-wise. Mm. And if you think of like the marks on the table, the actual kitchen table that's a recurring motif throughout, but also the light. I mean, the light is extraordinary. I know I sound really like going really over the top here, but honestly, I've watched it about 4 times in a row, this film, because I love it that much. But like the light, just the way it's like dappled light or something, there's something about the softness of that, which combined with the percussive kind of full-on
with the dialogue,
intensity and the sadness text. And yeah. trauma within the words, really allows you to somehow access it. Like I've had my own trauma and I find it hard listening to those words, even though my experience as a gay man obviously is not the experience you're directly talking about in this, but there's definitely a parallel yes. to the gay community and like violence in relationships that can happen that not many people really talk about much. Yeah. And I found it quite hard at first, and then I kept focusing on that light and then that allowed me to watch all like 17 minutes over it, and then I just got so into it because I wanted to explore it. But the more I was watching it, even on like that there's a recurring motif as well as tea and kind of leaking tea and and the mugs you chose, just like everything, it's so well done.
Thank you, mate. So that kitchen table, that was my mum's kitchen table. We shot it in my parents' living room. I painted the walls that sort of dark gray and we lit it and we shot it there. And that's actually the room that my mum died in. And so when I was sat there in that room about to say her words about this experience, about her experiences, she was a survivor, about bleeding and bruising and the relationship, you know, she left this world thinking I was okay, and I wanted her to feel that I was okay, and I wasn't. And she was very, very worried about my choice at the time, that relationship that I was in. She, you know, she knew all was not as it seemed, but sat there. And when it was like, when we were rolling, I think what you guys are talking about in terms of my performance, because I'm a shit actress, don't get me wrong. Like I remember doing theatre in school and being like, what am I supposed to do with my hand? Like I became so concerned with what's my hand? Why everyone's looking at my hand? It was awful. Most self-conscious ever. But sat in that spot there, I just, I accessed, like it was all real. Everything I was saying was coming from a really integrated place. But what were we talking about? Light. Sorry. Tangentially. But when you were talking about the cups, so I actually started working for the first time with ceramics for a show that I did in 2019. And this was after my mum had died. And for me, mum is tea is mum, tea is home. and obviously nurturing and all of that good stuff that we all, that's what we love for about a cup of tea. And I wanted to make work again that was close, that was with my hands. But I wanted to speak to this experience of having pieces missing. When you, and I know you have experienced this, Rob, I'm sure you have too, Russell, is that trauma or grief or heartbreak, it's not so much that we overcome it, it's just that we learn to live with these gaps now, and we're still whole. And when you look at us, we might even look the same. So I created these teacups, but I cut out these shapes so that, of course, they would never function as teacups. But that's what loss does to us. And I think also the experience of watching my mum's body warp and stop functioning, I was exploring that with these ceramic pieces as well. So I wanted to bring those into the film at the kitchen table. And so I shot these very slow-mo moments of tea spilling out of these ceramic cups.
The holes you're describing in the cups that you've kind of, you know, incised out in a way in the clay, they almost look like scars as well. So there's that kind of sense of like scar tissue. And I was talking recently with Ronan McKenzie, who's a previous guest on Talk Art. She's a photographer, curator, and also fashion designer. Now she has her own fashion label. And she's been making these clothes, which I'll have to send you, which are like all about keloid scars. And wow. And they actually have the scars embroidered in all the dresses. Wear an outfit, it's got all of the scars like tracing the body. And she's trying to show that you can be proud of these scars, and it's stuff we all try to hide or like treat with like creams. And it really made me think of that as well. Like, I was going to send her the film because I think she'll really like the film, but there's this, like, there's something about scarring as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this idea of staining, that was something that I was speaking to my mum about a lot, because she reminded me of this old religious adage that man is a piece of gold and woman is a piece of silk. And if you drop gold in the mud, it's no problem. You just dust it off. But if you drop silk in the dirt, it's ruined forever. And that's also the shame and the stigma attached to trauma. And it's like, you know, we're dirty because of what has been done to us. And it's the patriarchy that tells us that we're dirty. And it's the patriarchy that does the thing to us that makes us dirty. And like, what the fuck, man? Like, Jesus. So the staining, having the tea, staining these tea towels was always supposed to be about being unable to stop something inevitable happening, and having something then marked but also beautiful. And that's what you were touching on, both of you, at the beginning, is that this work isn't the home is bad, being a woman sucks, or you know, if I was a queer man, I wouldn't be saying being a queer man sucks. It's like there are some very difficult, unfair things about these experiences, about being marginalized, about being discriminated against, about having our power taken away from us. And that at the same time, look at this joy that is birthed. Like, look at what women do and create. Look at what queer people do and create. Like, it's the resilience is just, it's infecting, isn't it? Like, people want to be around us. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. So they should. But also that idea of strength as well, that I think it's quite a difficult thing, especially if you think of like masculinity and this idea of like strength and how you have to be strong. And then if someone gets cancer, everyone's like, oh, they were a fighter. You know, she fought really hard. And this whole thing about having to be strong all the time. And I remember after certain traumas I've been through, you sort of just the next day pick yourself up, act like it hasn't happened until you break. And then you could probably go on for like 2-3 years, and then it's almost like some kind of armor that you put on, and you go out there and you battle and you try and be strong, but actually it's just that's quite a negative thing in itself.
Yeah,
you know, it got me thinking just now about like you know, like the used objects, like the found objects, the existing pieces that end up in your work. Is there something spiritual about that? Because there's this really weird like I think I've mentioned it before even on this podcast, but Paula Cole, the singer-songwriter who did I Just Want to Wait, whatever it was called. I Don't Want to Wait on the Dawson's Creek soundtrack. She was like the song on it. On her first, that's the one. Oh God, actually, let's hear Russell do that.
No, carry on.
Or will it be Sorry?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh yeah, something like that.
So her first album, it wasn't as big, but there was a song called I Am So Ordinary on it. And for some reason, it always comes to my mind. And when I was looking at some of your work earlier, it reminded me of a lyric that said, I know you need me like an old soft shoe. And it's about this boyfriend who is sort of secretly sleeping with her, but he's actually got like the perfect cheerleading girlfriend or something, you know, in like a college. And she's the kind of person that he leans on and goes back to sort of because he loves her, but she's like the old soft shoe. And it got me thinking about like these materials and like even the gloves and how some people chuck them away and they might be damaged or disgusting to them, but to you they've got this like soul or like spiritual soul, connection or something.
Yeah, absolutely. There is, I think, spirituality is such a big part of my life personally. And so I do, you know what, I think I'm just realizing something. Okay, so I'm a Jew, and that is definitely a big part of my identity. And I get that from my mum, but I am actually biologically Jewish on both sides. Mm-hmm. But we weren't religious or spiritual in any way, right? But I was supposed to know that I'm a Jew, and it was about jokes and generosity and slang and suffering and food. But I've had this deepening spiritual practice that actually is from a more Hindu tradition. And it involves song and dance and chanting and repeating these mantras. And like you guys have said, like, words are very important to me. I'm always talking to myself in my head or singing to myself in my head. And there's the words in my work. But the way that I connect to the unbounded or an idea of the divine is through mantra and music. And it is a practice. It's the Hare Krishnas, basically. I love them. They're total weirdos, but they're amazing. I love them. And there's a lot within that tradition about assigning meaning and value to inanimate objects. So you've got these deities in the temples and everyone's sat in front of them. And we're supposed to be kind of singing, and everything that you do is an offering to these deities. And when I first walked in the temple, I was like, okay, but these are dolls, right? Like, are we just all agreeing that, cool, yeah, like, dear Lord, engage me in your service in Sanskrit to dolls, yeah? Cool, that's what we're, sweet. But the collective unconscious is a very powerful thing. And I think that it speaks to this part of me that does assign, with a bit of imagination, meaning to things and stories to things that perhaps other people wouldn't see. Maybe I am insane. Or maybe it's a way for me to you know, explore and celebrate and exalt. And that practice of going, okay, you know what? Just for the sake of tonight, for this chanting, for this kirtan, I'm going to pretend that I am singing to the divine at this altar here. And I think that has probably been something that has impacted my artistic practice. But very long-winded.
Like freedom.
You can edit all of that.
No.
It sounds like freedom.
You've said that a theatre background has helped you to do this as well.
Yes. So
having a theatrical background. But this is your alter ego, and this is what Rob was talking about at the beginning, about this kind of shadow aspect of your psyche. And this has allowed you to create an artistic alter ego called Nomi.
Yes.
And this is someone that you carry with you always.
Yeah.
And has always been there, but now you are able to access and use for your practice and for your life in general.
Yeah. Absolutely. Nomi, so I was doing some Jungian psychology, some Jungian analysis, and he asked me to imagine the shadow aspect of my psyche, and I got kind of a picture of who she was.
Will you explain what that is as well, though, what the shadow aspect is?
Yeah, absolutely. So at first, the way he encouraged me to form a relationship with her, he was like, okay, please remember a time where you felt like you're most vulnerable. I was like, oh God, here we go. So I pictured myself and sort of like slumped in a doorway, almost distraught. And then he was like, now I want you to picture a side of yourself where you were your most powerful. And I remembered moments like when I was robbed at Screwdriver Point in Hackney, and
I went away and someone else took over, and I got out of the situation because I became the most gobby, loud, rowdy Zoe. And I don't even really remember the things that I said, but the two rude boys apologized to me and walked away.
Oh, well done. I got mugged by a screwdriver as well in Custom House once for a mobile phone.
This is a thing. Mine was for a mobile phone too.
Yeah.
Well, I know where they live.
I didn't. I got mugged in Brixton, but not with a
screwdriver.
Screwdriver. What'd you get mugged with? But they did steal my Peter Jensen bag. I think it was Peter Jensen or somebody.
I wonder if there's a hierarchy. Those were not the good robbers, babe. Mm. You know, if they didn't have a screwdriver,
they didn't have
that's
a screwdriver. Like, they went. They were fashion. They were fashion robbers.
Oh my god!
They stole my Peter Jensen bag. What?
Those are not real badmans. They're not real roadmans.
But anyway, you were regressing to that moment. Yes.
Yes, exactly. So the most powerful aspect of my psyche. And so he asked me to give her a name and Nomi. I was just like, her name is Nomi. Like, you don't know me. He's like, okay, great. Where is she right now? I said, she's in a cage. And I won't waffle on about this, but he said, why is she in a cage? And I was like, because if I let her out, she's going to kill everyone. And he was like, right, okay, so that's great. So we need for you to form a better relationship with Nomi, because we can't have her like out killing everybody, but also she can't be in a cage, Zoe. You've put her in a cage, not somebody else. You have. I said, I know. And he was like, I need you to speak to her every day. Like, she gave birth for you. She creates all your work for you. I bet you haven't thanked her, have you, Zoe? I said, no. And I realized she's probably there in my orgasm, and she's there in my laugh and my cackle and my scream and all of those things. And I don't really pay much mind to her. So he was encouraging me to, I guess, integrate with a part of myself that is, yes, all powerful, but also all creative and all loving and always free. And that I was the part that I really struggled with at first, was that no matter what I experience or have experienced, the idea is that I can connect back to a side of me that is actually unchanged by all of these things. And that's pretty cool as a tool. Yeah.
Well, I've got know me, you don't know me, but I want you to know me.
Yeah, exactly. I want you to know me, exactly.
I'm really happy we met, because I find the way that you respond to like events in your life, you have this kind of like curiosity, this kind of a kind of searching to find the reason why. Like, I don't know, there's some kind of like hope within all the investigations you're doing in your work that's almost like a reason to survive. Because I think when you experience traumas, when you, of any kind, it doesn't even have to be something super, super intense, dramatic, violent. It could be the smallest thing even. Because I think everybody has different ways that we respond to things, and you can get hurt by different things. But I think the idea of finding resilience, strength within, and I don't know, I just find that kind of inquisitive nature that you have to explore so exciting. There's a positivity in it. That's what I'm trying to
say. Well, it allows you, I think I've heard you saying, it allows you a freedom in the present to go back and to retrace your trauma. And I guess art therapy, as well as your craft, is putting it out there, but it gives you a freedom to exist now.
Yeah, I mean, and also, honestly, if shit things have to happen to us, we might as well let them be the things that we pay our bills with, like... Because I like shoes, guys. I like new shoes. And so...
to find some sense of joy.
Your work, you have a daughter. Is your daughter asking lots of questions about your work?
Yes.
How are you approaching that? How old is she?
Yeah, so she's about to be 11. Right. And for sure, it is, to be honest with you, it is part of the reason why I'm excited about this move, because my studio is not going to be so in her face as well as in my face. There's definitely studio visits where if she's back from school and she's with me, I find this really awkward. Like, I want to answer a question in the studio visit authentically, but there's things that she doesn't need to know now, you know, at this point. But for sure, it has sort of been a forum for some amazing conversations between me and my daughter. She'll come over and she'll read something and she'll be like, oh God, Mom, what does that mean? And I'm like, okay, here we go. Just going to talk to her about this now. So I think for the most part, it's been really good. But I am also aware of wanting to protect her a little bit, you know. Mm.
Got it.
Yeah.
No, amazing. You're amazing.
You're amazing. You guys are amazing. You're amazing.
Do you find it? I think you sound more like me than you do Rob. Yeah. Do you find it being in the States that you constantly have to repeat yourself?
Yes. So I don't say, I say water because I cannot be bothered anymore. So I'm like, excuse me, mate, can I have some water?
Exactly. I would end up just talking with American accent.
Russell does. I go to visit him in New York and he sat there talking in American. And I'm like, why are you doing that? And he's like, to be understood.
Does he call you Rob?
Because I don't want to just repeat myself over again.
Whereas I just get, your name's Robert? Robert? They never say Rob. If you say Rob, they go, what?
Rob.
What are you called?
So
you
have to be Rob.
Robert. That's one of the main reasons I became Robert, like using my full name, was so that Americans would talk to me.
But Russell, but just to say, yes, though, you know that your accent is currency out here, though, babe. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Listen, absolutely. To the industry, yeah, to the people who you're trying to just, yeah, like, fair, just meal from or a drink, they find me yeah, like an alien.
You might get work, but you're going to be dehydrated.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll starve to death and I won't be able to drink anything, but I'll be working.
Well, for me, so if I'm feeling lonely, I just find a packed street in New York and I just walk around going, avocado, avocado, and I wait for someone to hit on me. I'm telling you, works every time.
There's a top tip for all of our listeners. If you're wondering how to get dates in the States.
I didn't know that. Oh, my God, I need to
Well,
try.
Rob's going to be trying.
Yeah, baby, come
out right
come
now.
Out here.
It won't work in Margate, Rob.
Oh, okay,
I promise you. So we ask every guest three questions now, the same three questions at the end of every interview. And the first one is, if you could do an art heist. Now, you are friends with lots of our art heroes. Mm. And I don't know if you do art trades ever, but if you could do an art heist and have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would that be and why?
Oh, it would be a Louise Bourgeois work, and it would be a textile piece and probably one of those padded books with the text on it. I love those. Yeah.
Have you traded art with your friends? Who are your art crew out there?
Okay, so I have Toyin Oji Oditola, who I know you guys love, and she drew me for my 30th birthday and gave it to me.
Oh, no.
God.
I know. You're so jealous. Eat it, you guys.
Wow.
I know. So sweet. And then we also traded as well. So I have another piece. It's a drawing of her brother. I have a Wangechi Mutu. She got in touch with me about one of the pieces of lingerie with, I think it has a Tupac lyric embroidered on it. And I have a print of hers in exchange. Wow. Who else? Oh, Hank Willis Thomas.
Cool.
And then me and Wardell. I don't know if you know this artist. He's amazing. His name is Wardell Milan. I bumped into him 2 nights ago and we're going to do a trade.
Fantastic.
I love that.
I love art trade.
Can't believe Toyin drew. That's so cool.
I know.
That's She's like an art dream. Toyin's one of the most extraordinary artists on the planet. Yeah.
She's incredible. She works too hard, man. She needs to chill.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah.
So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
Oh my God. What? You can't ask that.
I just did.
Okay, it's jokes because actually no one's ever asked me that in my entire life. So this is the first thing that came to mind. Please forgive me. It's Heinz tomato soup red.
Really?
It's a pillar box red.
Yeah.
Is it
postbox? British postbox red.
No, because Heinz tomato...
It's sort of orangey.
Yeah.
Mm. Creamy.
Not pillar box. Heinz soup, Russ, is not a pillar box.
No,
or a postbox, whatever the word is. I'm not having that.
But
also, it smells, doesn't it? It makes me think of the smell of tomatoes.
Yeah.
So is that something that you miss from the UK?
Very much so, yeah.
Can you get it there or not? No.
You can, but it takes a really long time to arrive on Amazon and then it's dented.
It's just
like,
not
almost
the same.
No point.
Amazing. Do you buy shoes in that colour?
No, but I think I deserve some. Hello.
Some tomato soup shoes need to be part of your collection. If what is the best advice that you have ever received when it comes to your art?
Okay. The best advice I've ever received when it comes to my art is from a teacher and activist and curator called Jasmine Wahi. Her handle is Brown Girl Curator, and she's amazing. And she said to me that I should cannibalize my artwork. First of all, I love words that really fucking confuse you and stick in your memory. But the idea is that, you know, you can create something, and whether it was a successful work or not, you can at any point use it and expand it and build upon it, or break it down and deconstruct it and use it in your artwork. So in the film that you guys have seen, there's some audio that I use at the beginning and at the very end, and that is from I used it in my very first show here in New York, and I had secretly recorded my last family meal in our house before my parents sold it in Stokey. So I think that's, you know, just one of the my most recent examples where I took something, I used it, I showed it, and then 10 years later, I'm using it again in a different way.
Yeah, that's a great idea. It's good. Like sampling your own history of creativity, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's there. You've already put the time and potentially money into it. Like, go further with it. You know?
Love that. I love that.
Yeah.
That's really useful, actually.
Yeah. Practical, tangible shit, babes.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, can we see your work next, Zoe?
Thank you. Yes. Okay, so my next solo show is going to be at Pippi Howlsworth Gallery in November.
In London.
And I demand tea with you guys, or Heinz tomato soup, or dirty martinis in real life. So that's my, thank you. And that's my next solo show. And then there's a few group shows here. There's one at the Parish Art Museum, a gallery upstate, a two-person show with Vanessa German. An institution in Tribeca as well. Nice. But the solo show is the one that I really hope everyone will come to.
Amazing. Yeah. And you've also got work at the moment until September 23 in Baltimore, no? At the Baltimore Museum of Art.
I do. Thanks for reminding me. I've got work at the Baltimore Museum of Art and right now at the Museum of Art and Design here in New York.
Yeah, that show sounds amazing, called Garmenting.
It's a good show.
It's costume as contemporary art. It's really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and there's Nick Cave, some Louise Bourgeois, and some Sanford Biggers, so it's good people.
The MAD, brilliant. It made me think as well about Gillian Waring a bit, because she's been at the Guggenheim, and it made me think, interesting parallel. For everyone listening, you can go to zoebuckman.com, as well as Pippi Howlsworth's website. Pippi Howlsworth Gallery, a brilliant gallery in central London. But Zoe's own website has a huge archive of her different artworks, including all her sculptures. And then we will be sure to update everybody where they can see the film when it finally happens, because it'll be really interesting for people to hear this and then see the film. But I hope everyone gets to see it.
Thank you.
And are you on Instagram?
So grateful. I am just Zoe Buckman,
at Zoe Buckman, so you can follow her there. Well, thank you very much, Zoe. We have loved every minute of this episode.
Yeah, it's been amazing.
You're an inspiration to us, and I can't wait to give you a big hug when you come to London, or if we come to New York. See you soon. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
We'll be back very soon. Bye. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.